My lecture is entitled The Vocation of a Lawyer and the Virtues. In this talk, although I situate the discussion in the context of the legal profession, I am not just speaking to lawyers and would-be lawyers, but to anyone who needs to interpret rules and apply them for someone else, and also to anyone who advises other people. And even if you do not fall into one of these categories, I do hope that there is something of interest for everyone in the discussion on vocation and virtue. As a very preliminary matter, as Father Richard noted in the introduction, although I'm a law professor, I also still represent clients both as a consultant and as a practicing lawyer. So just as this talk fits somewhere between philosophy and professional development, my own work has one foot in the academic and one foot in the practical. My paper has three parts. First is a discussion generally about vocation and virtue, which has woven throughout it definitions of each word. It's important that I define what I mean by virtue and vocation for three reasons. First, because I'm a lawyer and we lawyers delight in definitions. Second, I'm delivering this paper in Oxford, the epicenter of all things analytic. Parsing words runs in the water here. And third, a very practical reason, we need to have a working understanding of what I am going to talk about, and the concepts of virtue and vocation are not necessarily popular concepts in Western culture today. I will warn you that the first part on vocation and virtue takes up about half my paper. The second part is a discussion of the four cardinal virtues, prudence, justice, fortitude, and temperance, and how they relate to lawyers and advisors, and how they can ennoble the role of lawyers and the role that lawyers and advisors play. The third and final section involves a conclusory reflection that I'll just sum up as the whole ball of wax. So if you're looking for my principal sources, I need to do some citations here. My principal sources are simple: Aristotle and Thomas Aquinas, and a few friends of Thomas. Also, for succinct definitions of prudence, justice, fortitude, and temperance, I will use the definitions set out in the Catechism of the Catholic Church. There seems to be no better set of succinct contemporary source definitions than the definitions in the Catechism. And for those of you who are not Catholic or even Christian, don't worry. You will find that the Catechism's definition of the four cardinal virtues will not offend your secular sensibilities, as they are wholly rooted in reason and nature. So part one, vocation and virtue. To set the stage, let me provide a framework for virtue with a scene from one of my favorite books that has nothing to do with lawyers and happens to be set right here in Oxford. And it's not the filming of Harry Potter. Evelyn Waugh's classic novel Brideshead Revisited is a book with many layers woven deeply with sentiments of faith, doubt, the search for truth, and the far-reaching power of grace. It is, in my view, one of the great fictional works of the 20th century. Brideshead is set in a genre of small-c Catholic literature that integrates the human and divine, emphasizes the unity of knowledge and the unity of reality, that there is no contradiction between science and faith, that there is no stark divide between the natural and supernatural, that there are no evil people, but there are decidedly evil acts. Waugh is part of a handful of 20th century writers who paint very flawed characters, but what lurks behind those characters is hope that humans have purpose and are ennobled for their purpose by acts, particularly small, repeated acts. The genre also does not shy away from the desolation and disorder that ignoring the small, repeated good acts brings. In other words, vice. I happen to think Brideshead Revisited is the best of the bunch in this genre. But there's a scene very early in the book where the two main characters of the first half of the novel, Sebastian and Charles, are on a picnic in Trinity Term. The scene is set in the heady days of undergraduate youth, full of passion and hope, along with a bit of excess of everything, and bumbling discovery of creation and where they fit in it. In the course of the picnic, Sebastian says at a moment of quietude, "I should like to bury something precious in every place where I've been happy. And then when I'm old and ugly and miserable, I could come back and dig it up and remember." Let me repeat that. "I should like to bury something precious in every place where I've been happy. And then when I'm old and ugly and miserable, I could come back and dig it up and remember." At first read, this line has the arrogance of youth, that being old is to be miserable. But Waugh does not mean to leave us with a superficial reading of the line. Waugh is talking about virtue. Sebastian bearing his individual moments of happiness is a reflection on how humans build their character through the accumulated small good acts of a lifetime. Sebastian hopes that by making the past memories of happiness accessible, his life in the future will be fulfilling. A life of good acts builds up a storehouse of happiness, such that there is no such thing as being old or ugly or miserable in a virtuous life. But the challenge is building up the storehouse of good acts that assemble our character, and this challenge comes in the form of specific acts we must undertake in whatever station in life we inhabit. This scene in Waugh's novel is brilliant, and I suggest sets the stage for much of the rest of the story. Sebastian is a Catholic, while Charles fancies himself an atheist. But that logically sloppy form of atheism, that's really agnosticism when you get down to it. By the end of the novel, Charles is a Catholic, and while Sebastian does not cease to be a believer, he spirals into vice, isolates himself, and in the end, his death is noted merely in passing. Sebastian, unfortunately, did not bury many pots of good acts, but buried many pots of poorly chosen acts, slipping into isolation and disorder. For a character who looms so large in the first part of the book, his death is so sadly quiet, we do not know, but we can only hope, that despite not having many moments of happiness to remember, God's grace, a hook upon a long thread, as Chesterton described it, grabs him back before the end, in much the way grace brings back Sebastian's wayward father before his end in the book. Well, the novel illustrates two important points in this discussion of virtue and in my paper, which St. Thomas teaches. Number one, virtue is always built on past acts. The four cardinal virtues we will discuss are dependent on our own personal past acts. And two, we are masters of our own acts, which lead us to our purpose. We're not masters of our purpose. We are masters of our acts. These two points become clearer, and perhaps they'll become clearer in a moment or two, but keep them in mind as a person embraces his or her profession and develops a professional life. A profession is not hatched in an instant, but is learned, and exercising that profession builds on acts and failings and course corrections. So to look at what virtue is, we need to step back and stipulate another premise of the paper, that humans have an end, or in other words, we are driving towards something or some state as humans. On the natural level, that end is happiness or fulfillment. I've made a big leap with this premise that there is a human end, and that end orients everything that leads to it. A purpose implies some normativity. Another unpopular view these days. The classical definition of virtue is, a virtue is an habitual and firm disposition to do the good. Okay, so that's my first definition. A virtue is an habitual and firm disposition to do the good. In short, virtue is a good habit, and by disposition, a virtue is something that perfects over time and makes it easier and easier to exercise acts in a virtuous way. It is by trying to live virtuously with the experience of much failing along the way that we seek happiness, that we seek our end. The virtues are our roadmap to our end. Now, we can't just say that we should all develop good habits and leave it at that. There is much more to it. Virtue must be situated in the framework of who we are as humans. And in this, we must go back before the Catechism, before St. Thomas, before the Gospels, and see the insights given to us from the people who sparked Western thought, the Greeks, specifically among them Plato and Aristotle. It's the folly of the modern era, in my view, that we tend to see the present and future constantly marching in a progress. On the contrary, some of the most important and practical points of human life have been known for millennia. We may have only had quantum mechanics and neuroscience for the past few decades, but we've had thousands of years to reflect on who we are as humans and what our purpose as humans is. This sense of purpose or end, both as humans and in our stations in life, is something we have lost in the modern project, and we have lost it in the legal profession. as I see it. Without a sense of purpose, we cannot know how to direct our good acts and obtain the virtues. This is why we can't just say, do good, be just. Those are hollow phrases without a purpose or direction. The notion of ends is often referred to as teleology, taking this term from the Greek word telos, end. Purpose was thrown overboard, however, by philosophers of the Enlightenment, and we still suffer from the effects of abandoning purpose. Denying purpose became canonical in the Academy of the 20th century and is still alive and strong today in the Academy. But this abandoning purpose, both culturally and particularly in education and formation, impacts how people are prepared to not only live their life, but to live their professional life. Denying purpose not only is like losing the map of life, but is also denying reality if we deny that our existence does not mean anything. I see the abandonment of purpose also as a crisis in the profession as lawyers and in how the law is used. There is a tendency to see law as merely a neutral instrument to be used for immediate goals, no different than the instruments in a toolbox, completely separated from any natural function. Rather, serving the whims of whoever gets a hold of the toolbox, or in the case of lawyers, the whims of whoever pays the lawyer. This is not isolated to the legal profession by any means. Instrumentalism permeates many professions today, but it seems to be particularly pernicious in the great classic professions of lawyer, physician, teacher, soldier. These professions are capable of so many good things, but without an end, a proper purpose, these professions are rudderless. Instrumentalism as a professional mode I see today starting in legal education, where the instrumentalist view of law is predominant, particularly in my home setting in the United States. The instrumentalist view sees where there is no purpose to law other than to use it to achieve whatever it is that this or that person or social experiment wants to achieve. The goal is to get your hands on the toolbox as quickly as you can in order to benefit your group or your cause. Sometimes this is dressed up in law schools with a vague notion of quote-unquote social justice. But this is a shallow term without definition when it has no reference to any normative sense of justice or a longer-range goal. This has become very popular in law school education in the United States. That the basis of the education, the purpose of the education, is for social justice. But it's very rarely defined. It is, however, not surprising that instrumentalism is the mode because the cynical view of law derives from a cynical view of the world of man as animals with no purpose, making it up along the way, masters of our own nature, masters of our own purpose. Law is far more than instrumental. It is the outward sign of a community regulating itself and making clear what is due to each other. Law should, if it is a proper law, advance the common good while respecting persons to foster a community of friendship. The loss of a sense of purpose for law and the legal profession has profound impact on society and sends enormous signals in the culture at large. In the legal profession in the United States, the most weighty pronouncement on this mode of instrumentalist thought was made not in the past 5 or 10 years ago, but 27 years ago, by Justice Anthony Kennedy in the Casey case, in which to justify his decision, he anchored his reasoning in what he identified as, quote, the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning of the universe, and of the mystery of human life. The right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning. This not only severs normative purpose from human life, it severs law from being nothing but a blunt instrument of power and charges the lawyer with using law as nothing more than a weapon. It turns the lawyer into a mercenary. This view of humanity and law will ultimately fail, in my view, and is on a dangerous path to misery because it is not real. Although fantasy cannot succeed because it is not real, it can do enormous damage along the way. This idea that we can define our own concept of existence, we can define our own concept of meaning, is rudderless. Our end, our purpose, anchors who we are. It directs what we are to do. It pulls us along the path if we cooperate. Our purpose does not constrict us, it frees us. Does a map restrict travel? No, it enables travel. The modern world abandons purpose and tells us that we can all create our own identity, choose who we are, propose that rights precede duty, but this gets us nowhere because it simply does not conform to what is real. Okay, now I have to admit, this was the gloomy part of my paper, so I'm going to try to be a little bit more positive. As we reflect on our purpose as humans and the role of lawyers and the virtues, I would commend to you the late Cardinal Francis George's last book, A Godly Humanism, finished only a few weeks before he died in 2015. Cardinal George paints a hopeful picture of what it means to be human, which means to be integrated with the world and in touch with our nature. Being in touch means reclaiming purpose and fostering virtues, not just out in the world, but starting with ourselves, in our own station, in our own professions. Sometimes it's easier to work on the world than it is to work on ourselves. Cardinal George cautions that when we resist reality, we see breakdown, disorder, and misery. The book is a reminder of how simple a formula that has been given to us in our bodies, our families, our friendships, and our communities, but how difficult it is to accept the path of that map. It seems we are always trying to make things more complicated than what they are. And since I'm a lawyer, I can attest that lawyers also are very, very good at making things complicated. But interestingly, I do not think Cardinal George's book is directed at the godless, the moderns, or the so-called progressives to castigate them. It's actually directed at everyone, believer or non-believer, as a warning that we must look at our lives, our communities, our professions, and be leavened to the world by being authentic humans, reflecting on our actions, our purposes, and examining our conscience as a constant striving for improvement. If virtue is built on past acts, we always need to start the day anew, stockpiling that storehouse of good acts, even if yesterday the pile was fairly slim. I've mentioned that our natural purpose is happiness or fulfillment. That's a happiness, fulfillment, as many of you probably know, it's an unsatisfying translation of the Greek eudaimonia. Now, from Aristotle. Now, Aristotle did not mean by happiness a euphoric state or achieving residence in an endless pleasure palace. He meant by happiness a type of flourishing and contentment. This is deep fulfillment, is what he's meaning. It is resonance with nature, accord with the track of life. This gets a bit hard to describe to our modern ears because we have been conditioned to think of happiness as pleasure or achievement or defining our own existence, defining our own meaning. This is nowhere near the idea of happiness for Aristotle. Though he did conceive of a type of joy and peacefulness that does come with happiness. How might we describe this happiness? Well, many people have tried in many ways. Let me try and add to the heap. Hopefully, we have all had glimpses of happiness and deep fulfillment, even if they've been fleeting. Imagine a few moments of your life when you have had deep satisfaction. It's not necessarily pleasurable, but something that is deeply satisfying. Perhaps you've had a moment with your family when, despite hardships and struggles, you have a sense of things being right. For the lawyers or advisors in the room, you may have seen a client struggle to do the right thing and then make a difficult and hard choice. Or perhaps you have helped someone and felt satisfaction in their choices. Or, for some of you, you may have witnessed a person dying who is at peace with death, despite their pain, and you oddly seem to have shared in their peace. None of these are pleasures, which is an important point. But there is contentment. There is a joy, even if there isn't a pleasure. This deep satisfaction is a glimpse of human fulfillment, of flourishing. It is in those moments you are in accord with being human and have a touch point with what we are built to achieve, happiness. Another point about happiness is that it is not a hump we get over and then we're there, we're happy. It's smooth sailing, just a life of bliss. Happiness is a work in progress. It is worked on throughout our life. Aristotle notes that we do not become good by watching. We must act, because that's what humans do. We act. We must do good acts. Virtue is a good habit, and a disposition. But a habit and disposition of what? A habit of good actions. Virtue develops over life in choosing the good over and over again. There are no passively virtuous people. There are no passive saints. What are the good acts which make up virtue? They are acts of right actions, acts that move us closer to our end, our purpose. And along the way, there is a remarkable irony in virtue. Although virtuous acts perfect us individually, they are never self-oriented. They are always directed outward, always directed towards others. They're always social. Selfishness, isolation, is the enemy of virtue and the enemy of happiness. Selfishness is the handmaiden of disorder and misery. This disorder of action is what is called vice, bad habits. Vice builds on itself in a similar way as virtue. As much as we can have good habits, we can also have bad habits. Vice is slippery because it is seductive and always comes in disguise as a good. No exceptions, ever. Vice is always setting up a contradiction. This is also a hallmark, in my view, of the modern era. Thriving on contradictions, confusing freedom with autonomy, and spiraling into isolation. There is no friendship in vice, except the most base utilitarian kind. It also seems friendship is something that we are losing rapidly, or a sense of friendship. The glaring contradictions of the modern era, unwilling to accept anything normative and unwilling to acknowledge faults, brings to mind a line from Elizabeth Anscombe, which I will slightly paraphrase. How can the world be so relativistic and so judgmental at the same time? So in this long windup to set our foundation, what is virtue? It is a good habit, building a disposition to do good. We might even say it is a form of life that points us to personal happiness, but it is ironically never self-oriented. Virtue is also practical. It's not just theory, as we'll see in a moment. Now, vocation. A few words on this before I move on into the setting of a lawyer. Vocation. Before we move on to the practical and look at the four cardinal virtues in the professional life of a lawyer, let me go back to the title, The Vocation of a Lawyer. What do I mean by vocation? Vocation derives from vocare, to call. We often think of vocation in the context of a calling to the religious life or to ordained ministry. And in a Christian sense, we all have a vocation and a universal call to holiness. But there is a diversity in how to live out our vocation. This diversity of vocations allows everyone to look at their situation to figure out how to be dedicated to the role they play in society, for their own fulfillment as well as aiding in the fulfillment of others. That situation of life may be as a parent, student, friend, employer, employee, or a more formalized profession, such as a teacher, physician, or lawyer. In every station in life, we have a vocation. We are called to use that role as a means of achieving our end or purpose. In fact, it seems we rarely have one vocation, but interact in the world in many ways so that this diversity of vocation gives us many opportunities to exercise roles in society that lead us to our end. There are certainly some unique vocations which seem called by God in which people respond, particularly those in ordained and consecrated life. I'd also add the married state and parents. But we also make prudential choices on how to live our lives, and if those are good choices, then we find ourselves in need of concentrating on how to live that life well, and in professions, how to live that profession well. Now, am I called to be a lawyer by God the way a priest is called by God to ordained ministry, or a mother or father is called by God to be a parent? No, not in the same way. A priest, a mother, or father is a permanent thing. A priest cannot cease to be a priest. A mother is always a mother, and a father is always a father. These are things that cannot be undone. It is ontologically impossible for a mother to cease to be a mother. It is impossible for me to cease to be a son. But I could be a good son or a bad son. I can cease to be a lawyer, however. That's something I can cease to be. In fact, many lawyers, that is an immediate goal, is how do I get to something else? But the point is that I am a lawyer. Some of you are likely lawyers. Some of you maybe would be lawyers. Others of you, most everyone here, is in a profession or on a way to a profession. I find myself in a profession, which happens to be a lawyer, and it has a purpose in society, and that calls me to an end. The end of a thing always calls the thing to that end. The end always sets the goal, and we must figure out the path. That calling, vocation, the calling of the end or purpose requires me to do my best to live up to this role for the good of society and to promote human flourishing. So this leads me to, what is the purpose or end of the legal profession? What is the legal profession calling me as a lawyer to do? It is not to help myself, though it may provide the material means for me to live in society, as any job does. Lawyering is never about the lawyer, but about the client, and assisting the client through the law and the complexities of the state, of protecting the client when accused, advising the client how to follow the rules of society, and assisting in the order and right relations of society. The purpose of a lawyer is not to use clients as pawns, either as merely a way to wealth accumulation or to advance the lawyer's own conception of justice. Both phenomena are rampant in the U.S., in which the client gets lost in the ulterior goals of a lawyer. For those of you who might follow U.S. Supreme Court law, which are the big cases, a lot of times the clients, the people, the humans involved in those cases are lost in the shuffle. Now, there are often great principles involved in those cases, but we often know very little about the people who spurred that case on. So with all this in mind, virtue as the way to happiness, vocation as the call to live out well our station in life, and the purpose of lawyering to aid others in relation to the law, let's look at the virtues in the context of professional life with particular attention to lawyers. That was my long, windy part one. Part two, much shorter. Plato first identified the cardinal virtues. Didn't call them cardinal virtues. That didn't come along until the fourth century. But it is important to note that Plato did not invent the cardinal virtues. He named these characteristics of a good life. They weren't invented because they were always there. There was nothing to invent. He named them by reflecting on human activity and human life. Despite the great achievements of science, this insight of virtue by Plato is a discovery that no scientific experiment could ever achieve. The four basic virtues of human activity that we're going to talk about were named cardinal somewhere around the fourth century, allegedly by St. Ambrose. And cardo, coming from the word hinge, the four cardinal virtues are hinges to the moral life. They are sometimes also referred to as the moral virtues or the acquired virtues because we must work on obtaining them. Although Plato identified the four cardinal virtues, Aristotle elaborated on them and set them in the concept of a theory of action, right living, and purpose. We owe a great debt to Plato, but he has less of a sense of an end to human life than Aristotle does. Even more so, St. Thomas Aquinas utilized Aristotle's framework of the virtues and theory of action to unlock far more riches in the virtues. And St. Thomas also placed the four cardinal virtues in the context of grace. St. Thomas notably wove a theme of grace perfecting nature, in that the grace of God polishes and elevates the cardinal virtues to ennoble man beyond happiness to holiness. St. Thomas wrote extensively on three additional virtues, known as the theological virtues, faith, hope, and charity, which are gifts of God. These three are perhaps the topic of a different lecture, and perhaps I could just leave it as these three theological virtues are a bit like super boosters to the cardinal virtues. The virtues are not theoretical, but are lived actively. In the context of the life of a lawyer, I wish to move in and out of three relationships. And if you're not a lawyer, you've likely advised someone, whether it's a friend who's sought your advice or in some other professional capacity. So you might find analogies. But with respect to lawyers, three types of relationships. First, the lawyer and his or her client. Second, the lawyer and the law. Third, the lawyer and the community. Now, by law here, I mean positive law, either an external command or the legal bond that forms in private lawmaking, such as contracts or social convention. I do not mean to short shrift natural law, but the grist of a civil lawyer's day-to-day work is positive law. By community, I mean not only the local civil community in which the lawyer practices, but also the immediate community that he or she works within, the firm, the partnership, the office in which the lawyer works. That is, those persons, the idea of community are those persons with whom your sphere of influence and interaction have their immediate effect. Now, as I mentioned, I will use the definitions from the Catechism. The Catechism's articulation of the virtues is a mixture of Aristotle and St. Thomas. And we'll take each of them in the order that St. Thomas writes about them. And although there's a little bit of logic to how St. Thomas lays them out, the most important point is not the order in which they are set out, but that theme of unity, that they work together. Among the four cardinal virtues, there's also a common feature, self-regulation, which is a manifestation one might see as of Aristotle's golden mean. Now, self-regulation, as we'll talk about, is particularly manifest in temperance, but I think self-regulation is there in all four of them. Another important aspect of these virtues as we walk through them is that you may see them as merely common sense on how to live out life and how to live out a profession. And that's because they are common sense. It's exactly what they are. But how often it is that we need reminders of the small things, how often we need reminders of common sense and how to work with common sense. St. Thomas's description of original sin is apt in describing the effect of original sin as darkening the intellect, not darkening in the sense of introducing evil to the intellect, but introducing a type of muddle and confusion, an intellectual sloth that clouds our own use of common sense. So it's important to be reminded of this. We might not know how the muddle got there. I'll leave that to Father Richard's academic research in original sin. But the muddle does seem to be there. As many of you likely know, Chesterton sardonically noted that original sin is the only provable dogma. We just have to look around and we see it. So let's start this with prudence. Prudence. The Catechism notes that prudence is the virtue that disposes practical reason to discern our true good in every circumstance and to choose the right means of achieving it. Discern our true good, choose the right means of achieving it. Prudence is a regulation of our choices. Now, it's not always that we're confronted with two choices where one is bad and one is good. We're often confronted with choices of two goods, of several goods. Anyone who advises anyone else has probably used the phrase, you could do X, but it would be prudent to do Y. This is a choice between two goods. Prudence also has a long-term interest in mind. It seeks to steer the choice away from the immediate gain. The immediate gain might not be wrong in itself, but prudence asks, is there a better choice? Prudence zeroes in on the action that has the best chance of achieving the best good in the long run. Prudence disposes us to do better. A hallmark of building up prudence to me seems to be considered deliberate judgment. When prudence becomes a habit, that judgment goes quicker and giving long-term interest advice becomes second nature. But making decisions too quickly without practice is dangerous and does not help the virtue of prudence. So thinking through things in a considered, deliberate way. But there's a danger, too. If you're too considerate, too deliberate, you slow down. You become paralyzed and in indecision. That's not good in giving advice either. So both haste and indecision are not good grounding for right action. They're not the fruit of prudence. With respect to advising a client as a lawyer, prudence is critical. And we'll stay in the moment of giving advice. haste or indecision is a disservice to a client. But haste and indecision we often think about as coming early in a career, but it can come anytime in a career. I certainly experienced both of these as a young lawyer. As a young lawyer, I was conflicted in giving advice. I struggled to give advice out of fear of giving the wrong answer, of leading somebody down the wrong path, of both obtaining liability of myself for giving malpractice, as well as not advising someone on how the right way is to follow the law. So it became paralyzing for a while. But at the same time, in some instances, I was too sure of myself. So I was too quick to give advice, too quick on the draw. So hasty advice. And hasty advice becomes haphazard and inconsistent. This happens later in our careers as well. And I know this as an older lawyer, that many times I'm too hasty. I'm still too hasty sometimes in giving advice. I might think I know all of the facts and that I've seen this scenario before, but I haven't paused to ask whether I have a good understanding of the facts in order to give that advice. And other times, and I think this happens particularly with lawyers in niche areas, such as I work in a lot in healthcare regulations and biomedical research regulations, where it's very hard to keep up with the accumulation of laws. And so I can be paralyzed in not knowing whether there's a new law. Well, these are very practical problems of lawyering, but I have to muddle on and get through it. But if I'm caught in either haste or indecision, I'm not doing a good job for my client. I'm not doing a good job in my profession. Now, there's no easy answer. There's no manual on how to be a lawyer. There's no manual on how to be a profession. There's no manual on how to be a human. We have to practice it. There's no rule book for acquiring the virtues. All of this only comes with practice and assessing what went wrong when we fail. We need to keep practicing and examining our actions our whole life, whether that's in our profession or in our personal life. The Catechism cites Proverbs in discussion of prudence, and it's the Catechism cites the quote, "The prudent man looks where he is going." That is, the prudent person is not looking just at the immediate decision, but he or she is looking where the immediate decision leads. The person is looking down the road to the end. Clients do not always appreciate this, but as lawyers, we owe them the best advice we can give them, and that is looking at their whole interest, not just whether they can do the immediate next step. This is where the instrumentalist view of law is quite damaging to the legal profession. It's quite damaging to the legal profession. Just because you can do something, just because something is legal, does not mean you should do it. Second virtue, justice. The Catechism states, this is a bit long, I should have had a handout, justice is the moral virtue that consists in the constant and firm will to give due to God and neighbor. Justice toward men disposes one to respect the rights of each and to establish in human relationships the harmony that promotes equity with regard to persons and to the common good. The harmony that promotes equity with regard to persons and to the common good. I'll note that this definition includes persons and common good and puts them on equal footing. So what is justice when we step back? Well, we might think for a moment that justice is what lawyers are all about, obtaining justice for our clients. And that's mostly true. But the virtue of justice does not start with the big matters or the big cases. It starts more immediately with how we treat others, how we respect others. Justice is right relations between individuals and giving everyone his or her due. Our family, our friends, our neighbors, our coworkers, our community, the people in our community. As lawyers must give our clients their due and we must respect legitimate authority as an important element in moderating society. Sometimes, respecting that legitimate authority means being courageous in telling the client that they can't do what they want to do. Moving a bit away from practicing law to law itself, we might indeed think about justice in a broader sense of special obligation that legislators have for ensuring that laws focus on giving everyone their due, that laws are fair. In the United States, the culture that I imbibe is conditioned a bit on thinking of rights first when we think about law. It's a rights-oriented discourse. I think, in my estimate, we focus in the United States too much on rights, too much rights talk, to the detriment of obligation or duty. The right I quoted above, as articulated by Justice Kennedy, the right to our own concept of existence, the right to our own concept of meaning, is as unshackled from duty as it gets. In having an unfettered right to define our own existence, there is no duty to think of other people or duties at all. The extreme version of rights talk denies the social dimension of human activity and the balance of relations. And in fact, I think, although this is sometimes a loaded term, I think Justice Kennedy's line, this right to define our own existence, right to define our own meaning, is really the epitome of antisocial sentiment. So this rights talk, it's not isolated to the United States. And I certainly don't want to leave anyone with the impression that I'm against rights in any way. It's just a proper balance of rights and duties, which is my main point here. But this rights talk is also woven into EU constitutional law in the Charter of Fundamental Rights of the European Union as part of the Treaty of Lisbon. The duty-free right, as is described in the treaty, is on the rise, playing out in EU case law. Now, here in Britain, and I'm just a casual observer of this past year, my observation is you are at a crossroads. There is much rights talk here in the UK, but it seems to me that there is a more grounded culture of obligation than there is in the United States. Though I'll leave it all to you, who are residents here, and as to whether that's slipping away or whether you disagree with me or agree with me. An important aspect of justice, however, is that there are no rights without duties. So all of this rights talk is shallow if it isn't followed up with a discussion of duties and obligations. Now, although I think rights and obligations come together, and certainly even the Catechism talks about a right, what I don't think justice is necessarily a balancing of rights. If anything, it's a balancing of obligations. But the wisdom of millennia does not start with rights. I'm not sure that it even starts with duties and rights. It starts with measured relations and looks at what are the correct relations between people. When relations are rightly balanced, then there is justice. When relations are out of balance, then there is injustice. But taking it down to a more immediate matters in our life, how does a lawyer exercise justice? How are they disposed to justice? With respect to clients, it involves representing them and advising them to the best of our abilities. It also involves very concrete matters, such as ensuring that a lawyer does not overcharge a client. Not an insignificant problem in this profession. Making sure that the lawyer's invoices and bills fairly represent the work performed, that you actually did the work that you're charging the client for. Ensuring that when taking on a client, a lawyer does not overpromise what the lawyer can achieve. This is an important matter of justice to the client, not overpromising. It's essential that a lawyer be honest with his or her client. Just the way if you're giving advice to anyone, it's important that you're honest, that you don't overinflate their expectations. Outcomes are not assured. Interpretations may be filled with risk as to whether a court or magistrate will agree with the interpretation. The client also may be asking the lawyer for an impossible outcome, and the lawyer owes the client honesty that the goal cannot be achieved. It'd be unjust to take on a case that you know is simply can't be accomplished. Sometimes justice requires not taking a client as well. Does the client want to achieve something out of spite or envy? Does the client have malicious intent, even if their surface action is legal? The duty in that case may not be to a potential client, but the duty of justice may be to the third party who will suffer from the pernicious lawsuit or malevolent termination of a valid contract. What can be done is not always what must be done. What is legal is not always the right thing to do. Justice is measured just like prudence. It is deliberate, it is thoughtful, it's difficult. Now, the Catechism, in its discussion of justice, concludes with a curious passage from St. Paul, a little harsh on our modern ears. It says, "Masters, treat your slaves justly and fairly, knowing that you also have a master in heaven." Now, in quoting this today from St. Paul, the Church is not condoning slavery in this line, but is bringing this passage to our attention to remember that we must treat people who work for us with justice. Work for us and with us with justice. This is of particular importance to members of a professional class that often employ others or have subordinates working for them. The employee owes an honest day's work for the wages he or she receives, but the employer owes respect to the employee. This has been a problem with the legal profession in the U.S. as well as here in Britain. Other professions have this problem too, but I can't speak to those. But it's been a challenge in the legal profession to cultivate a just workplace environment in law firms. This has gone on for many, many decades. There is enormous pressure on the lawyer. The lawyer, especially the more senior the lawyer becomes, is often alone in his or her decision-making and advice to the client. This is incredibly stressful, and the stressful can find its way out by being harsh on junior staff. I see this over and over again. As I say, I don't think this is unique to the legal profession. But when I was, it's gotten much better in the U.S., but there's still a long way to go. We can see this closer to home, how this is sort of taking this out on others, taking the stress out on others in the workplace. We could see this likely in our own lives, and because it's important to remind ourselves that it is easiest to be short and snappy with our closest relatives, our spouses, parents, children. The very ones we love the most are the ones we lose it with the easiest. I'll leave this to the sociologists and psychologists to decipher why this is the case, but it seems to be a universal phenomenon. This behavior is often brought into the office, particularly in close working environments and under intense pressure. Yelling, belittling, and not being attentive to the other person cannot be excused by the stress and strain of a profession you have chosen. So a good office work environment, as cheerful as possible, is critical for justice. This certainly goes for non-lawyers as well. The third, fortitude. The Catechism next discusses fortitude, which is often also referred to as courage. The Catechism says, "Fortitude is the moral virtue that ensures firmness in difficulties and constancy in the pursuit of the good. It strengthens the resolve to resist temptations and to overcome obstacles in the moral life. The virtue of fortitude enables one to conquer fear, even fear of death, and to face trials and persecutions. It disposes one even to renounce and sacrifice his life in defense of a just cause." Well, courage in the legal profession is challenging, mostly in the small things. When there is great injustice, it is sometimes easier to be courageous. But in the small things, it's hard to be courageous. Are we willing to walk away from a client rather than cooperate with evil or with an illegal decision, especially when they're a well-paying client? As lawyers, we stand separately from the client. The client must always make the decision. All we as lawyers can do is advise. But what if the client makes the wrong decision? And I'm not talking about choosing between two goods, but choosing something bad when the choice was between something illegal and something good. Do we stay with the client because they are that good-paying client? Unless they're not a well-paying client, good-paying client. Do we look the other way because of the money coming in? Or do we exercise the courage to walk away? Even this example, choosing between a client that does illegal acts and those that you're helping to enable, and the client that when they don't choose the good, this is an example of something big, a big example. It's still the smaller issues that are harder to be courageous on. So perhaps you have had the occasion to talk to a friend, if you're not a lawyer, who wants advice. If anyone's asked you for advice, then you experience the same thing that a lawyer does when a client comes to you and asks you about the law or whether they can, how they can achieve something. What you have to ask yourself is, do you have all of the facts in order to give advice? Or do you need to ask for more facts and assure yourself that you have everything you need to give advice? This is a hard thing to do, because oftentimes lawyers receive questions from clients where you know the answer that they want. And you have a sense that they may have given you just enough facts, you know, just enough about the law, that you're going to affirm that goal, that you're going to affirm what they want to do. So you have to be courageous. You have to ask for more facts in order to give advice, and not take the easy way out. I suspect this has happened to all of us in professional life, student teacher life, family life, friendships. Now, the Catechism leavens this discussion of fortitude with spiritual encouragement. The Lord is my strength and my song. And importantly, in the world you have tribulation, but be of good cheer, I have overcome the world. A supernatural outlook is not necessary for the exercise of the virtues or to be courageous. But the church reminds us that Christian hope is an important boost to be courageous in times of challenge. Fourth, temperance. Now to the last of the four cardinal virtues, temperance. The Catechism says, temperance is the moral virtue that moderates the attraction of pleasures and provides balance in the use of created goods. It ensures the will's mastery over instincts and keeps desires within the limits of what is honorable. The temperate person directs the sensitive appetites towards what is good, and maintains a healthy discretion. In the context of the life of a lawyer, I wish to emphasize the latter part of this commentary. Temperance keeps desires within the limits of what is honorable, and the temperate person directs the sensitive appetites towards what is good and maintains a healthy discretion. We all have passions. They're useful. They're part of the way we are created. God did not make anything, even our passions, that could not be used for good. But self-regulation is key, again, particularly if we identify some unique dominant flaw or defect in our passions. And let's be honest, we're all a little off balance. We have some little defect that we have to work on, that we have to regulate. The church has for two millennia, in distinctions with many heresies, maintained that everything created is good. There is no thing which is evil, but all things could be used for evil purposes. Our passions, emotions, feelings all exist for a reason. They aren't bad. They're part of our makeup, but they must be regulated, or they could be used for evil. So, when we have a victory, say there's a court case that is won, there's a welling up of pride in your work. There's an emotion of elation. This is all good. There's nothing bad about that. But the emotions must be tempered to avoid gloating. We all know gloating is ugly and unattractive, often repulsive, but yet how often do we fall into the same trap of not regulating our pride when we have a win? Temperance is not just acting moderately against the other side, but it is acting, in the case of a lawyer in a court case, but it is acting moderately and soberly among our peers, among our colleagues and our coworkers. Wins are momentary, and we all know that we can't win every time. In victory, temperance shows itself in humility. Now, in loss, there must also be temperance. in loss, there is temptation to despair. I do not know which is easier to fall into, gloating or despair. Perhaps they are equally tripped, but it does seem as though despair is a harder spiral to get out of. Gloating, after a win, you'll soon enough get out of that because there'll be a SmackDown loss coming right around the corner, and that puts you in your place. But despair can paralyze a person. Despair drains the energy we need to keep going on. We've all seen this. Maybe we have even been in this situation. If you see this in a colleague, a peer, or client, we can be of tremendous help in offering a word of encouragement. A small, cheerful word of support goes a long way. In despair, we see someone withdrawing from the social order. And when you withdraw from the social order, withdrawing from our purpose, our road in life to happiness. Sometimes it takes other people, which makes sense in a social world, to help another out of despair. So these are the four cardinal virtues. And with them, we have the hinges of moral life, the hinges of living out whatever it is we are called to do. My goal was to put these in the context of lawyering. Now, we're pretty much out of time, so my third part, luckily, is very, very brief, and my last piece. So bearing in mind that the cardinal virtues are dispositions that must be worked on over a lifetime, I'd like to draw a conclusion with a few practical points which hopefully may help us build on good acts in developing the virtuous life. And for those of us who are Catholics, we know that before going to confession, it's advised to do an examination of conscience. But I think whether you're Catholic or not, an examination of conscience is on a regular basis is important. Examination of conscience before confession is usually reflecting on your sins. And those could be great, those could be small. This also could be reflecting on our imperfections. How could we have done the day better? And for those of you that are not believers, well, an examination of conscience also seems to me to be a very practical way to work on developing a virtuous life, to look at our failings, to look at our bad acts, to learn from those activities and course correct, trying to get that storehouse of good acts that we build up. Recall, virtue is built on good acts, and I would suggest that good acts are often built on examining our mistakes and bad acts. While there are many lists and questions for an examination of conscience, and for the confessor in the room, please excuse me, for building my own brief examination of conscience for lawyers with respect to virtues in the profession. I have thought of 8 items that it would be good for lawyers to think about. Maybe not every day, maybe not every night before you go to bed, but occasionally. So, again, I think this applies to anyone who's an advisor. So in my advice to clients, have I been deliberative? Have I been too hasty or too indecisive? 2, have I accurately charged my client? Have I been just to my client in this way? 3, have I fairly performed my work today? 4, have I respected my colleagues' and clients' time by being punctual? I haven't talked about punctuality as a matter of justice, but that's something which physicians and lawyers, we all have a problem. I don't know if there are any physicians in the room, but punctuality is something lawyers have a difficulty with, and running over time is included in there. 5, have I listened to my clients to determine their needs and long-term interests? 6, did I give up on something too soon? 7, that's doing an injustice if you've given up on a client too soon. 7, have I had a win or loss today? And if so, how have I reacted? Have I kept the win or loss in perspective? 8, how have I treated my coworkers? Have I treated my coworkers with justice? Have I given them their due? Now, if you have found any of these 8 helpful, perhaps you can relate, if you're not a lawyer, to your own circumstances or your own profession. I also think that as a very practical matter, when we examine our conscience or we examine our acts, it's important to write down resolutions on how to do something better. Now, because I'm an advisor, because I'm a lawyer, I have to give you advice not to write down the bad acts that you did that day when you examine your conscience. That would be evidence of culpability discoverable in a trial. So, but if you write down the resolutions, that's something positive on a going forward basis. And those are the good acts that you want to do the next day. So I want to end this paper with reflecting on virtue back with Sebastian at the picnic. Remember what he said. I should like to bury something precious in every place where I've been happy, and then when I'm old and ugly and miserable, I could come back and dig it up and remember. Each of those buried treasures of happiness are accumulated good acts, which form habits, which builds character. The end of human life is not to grow old or ugly or miserable. The end of human life is happiness, fulfillment, flourishing, and friendship. Our work on that as humans and our work on the virtues in all of our lives is never at an end. Every day, in every profession, lawyer or not, we must strive for good acts and moments of happiness we can each bury and remember. Thank you.
Many thanks for the inspiring talk and for the examination of conscience, which I shall make some use of. There's time for some questions, sage comments, reactions, contributions. I'll just mention that there's a list of further Aquinas events for this term here, in case you want to take them away for yourself or others. But are there any questions, comments, contributions?
Edward.
Brian, I came a little late, so I might have missed something.
It's fine.
But I'm trying to pull together the two first and second pieces of this.
Uh-huh.
Your very pleasantly gloomy description of the decline of the West,
uh-huh.
and then your very upbeat description of Aristotelian or Thomistic virtues. Would it be easier to have Thomistic virtues if the West weren't declining, or do we need Thomistic virtues more because the West is declining? How do we see these two
well,
things coming together?
I suppose I would have to gently correct you in saying
absolutely.
That they're not Thomistic virtues, they're just the virtues.
Okay.
All right. But a Thomas's elucidation on them, perhaps. Okay. So we need the virtues whether we're in decline or not.
Right.
And I think that if we're not in decline, then we likely are exercising the virtues. The decline perhaps makes them sharper. It's easy to fall into the gloomy parts. It's easy to give the negative view of society, whichever side of the fence that you fall on. And it seems that I don't fall on the side in sympathy with the modern project, but many in the modern project see great gloominess as well today. But it's easy to get caught in that. That's potentially getting caught in the despair that I talked about. But I do think that the negative helps accentuate the positive pieces. And same thing in an examination of our own actions. If we examined our own actions and all we saw were good acts, well, I mean, perhaps that means you're a saint. But I think that there isn't any saint who examines their actions and doesn't see ways to do better. So I think we see that through the contrast.
Do you think that the people with the modern values that you were discussing in the first part would deny your description of virtues for the most part, or would they be happy?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. Because virtue is a bit of a universal term that all people like to embrace. I suppose I'm jealously sticking to Aristotle and to Thomas in view of virtue. It might be interesting to ask Justice Kennedy, who thinks we can define our own concept of the right of existence, unfettered by duty, what he thinks of virtue. I actually think that if you ask Justice Thomas, he might very well give something like I've described, but I don't know how it accords with that. Yeah. And perhaps, Edward, maybe that's this contradiction, this at least what I see, and perhaps this in many other ages, perhaps it's always an observation because we are flawed human beings, but this contradiction in our culture. That, yes?
I know very little about American law, but I do believe, because I'm afraid you were once a colony of Great Britain, was
yes.
A long time ago when we had an empire. It's very much predicated on English law, I suppose, to Scottish law, which, are, as you know, are different things. And it is an adversarial methodology, as opposed to what goes on the continent, which is Code Napoleon, which probably comes more out of Roman law, I think. But it's a different system. You've not mentioned the adversarial thing. I mean, am I right, Professor, in saying it is adversarial in America? So, but you know what we're talking about in England. It is very much adversarial. You have plaintiff, as they used to call it, and defendant in civil law. And that's what you're concerned with mainly, and so am I. Therefore, there is that antagonism, I think. I'm probably using a bad word there. Between the two parties, or more than two parties, but normally two parties. I do a lot of valuation for divorce cases.
So
I've done properties over £1 million. £1 million doesn't buy you that much nowadays. And you know one party, and I've been a sole a single joint expert, which is a very lonely place, because both lawyers, you have no lawyer to confide with. Everything is straight down the line. And I have to say, I am serving the court. Lord Wolf, we have CPR 35, you may be aware of that. We have to put it in our statement.
Right.
And that is my defence, really. I'm serving the court. I'm not taking sides. I'm blind to who wants...
Right.
You can work out whether the wife wants more money or whichever way, who's living there. Mm-hmm. That's not my job. And then you find out very quickly when they come back with questions. But there is this antagonism. So all this... you were talking about sort of, I'm trying to think of the words, where, I mean, even taking the side of a third party, another party or something like that, well, we have a duty to our clients, and the Law Society would, in England, would have a lot to say if you... So where do you weigh up that idea of adversarial arguing, which is, I think a way of finding the truth, and that's what justice is about, I think, against the idea of being sort of, I think you used the word friendly, to almost the other side, the other party, maybe. I think there is a real problem there, that people do get very adversarial and take one side, and I've seen it as the expert. I'm just putting a value on this property. I don't care what happens to it afterwards.
Right.
That's not. I mean, I do care that justice goes, and I have to put that value in, and it has to be a single value.
Yeah.
And I have to stand up in a court of law if necessary and justify why I have done that.
Yeah.
How do you square your circle?
I'm not sure I could square a circle, but three things. First, you as a surveyor, I think that's a different type of duty, because you do have a duty under law to the community, to the state, to the court, and to be objective and
not get sued.
Fair enough. You have a duty to yourself and your family to preserve your ability to keep a roof over your head, right?
Right.
Now, with respect to the legal systems, so the U.S. works under two legal systems.
Right.
One is inherited from English law and the common law, and the other, much like the UK, has a statutory law layered on top of it. We have a bit of a harder crust constitution than the UK does, right? But the common law, at base, and this is perhaps a different lecture, where I think the origins of the common law have a lot to do with natural law and basic justice, and this adversarial approach is... is sort of this search for the truth. But that's Beverly getting aside. The parts that I was criticizing on Wright's talk is not the parts that we share, the U.S. and England, in the common law. It's more of the language of the U.S. Constitution and much of the cases which come out of the U.S. Constitution. So our Constitution, as many people might know, is it's heavily Lockean, and in its origin, it's very rights oriented. I think if you and although you have a Bill of Rights and you have many rights that are articulated, I don't think the UK, the language in the law is not as strong. The language in the Treaty of Lisbon is closer to our the U.S. Constitution of this rights-oriented. So the basic points of common law, contract, tort, these points are the same, and I don't think in their purest form lends itself. That it actually is quite duty-oriented, and the wrongs that are attempted to be righted by representing a plaintiff is usually because somebody has not lived up to their duty or they breached a duty. The statutes and the U.S. Constitution flip all of that, and they start with rights. And as I mentioned, is sort of this unfetteredness. Now, the other thing that you mentioned about a duty to a third party, I simply think that there's a limit on the duty that an attorney has, a lawyer has for their client. We can't assist them. Part of this is not controversial. We can't assist them in doing things that are illegal. But we also have to live with our own conscience. We have to live with ourselves. So do you take the case because it's high paying? Do you take the case despite the fact that maybe you have a good case, but the client is just raging in spite, and you're participating perhaps in a case that's legal, but are you helping the person when you seek vengeance on them? Also, there are times where it's perfectly acceptable to, or it's perfectly allowed under the rules, excuse me, to sue someone. But it might be a minor matter. It might be a trifling matter. And so the expense that might incur on the other party is far outweighed by whatever the harm that the person suffered. And so there, I do think we have to step back and say we do have a duty to the third party. Now, we have to think about that before we're taking on the client, before we're taking on the case. If you're taking on a case, you know, I do think the situation is a little bit different if you're going to drop the client. So maybe I'll take a pass on that if you're in the middle of a case. But Lucy.
I think you may have slightly articulated it there, but where do you see the kind of intersection and the separation between virtues and professional ethics?
It's a great question for those of you who didn't hear the relationship between virtues and professional ethics. So one of the areas that I work in the U.S. healthcare system is an area called compliance or compliance law. So, which is there isn't quite anything analogous yet here in the UK, but the concept is not. I mean, the concept is just comply with the law. But in the US, what we have is we have organized programs that are part of businesses that help the business comply with the law. And in many instances, regulatory agencies require organizations to adopt these compliance programs. Interestingly, and I'm getting to your question, what the federal government in the US requires when they require these are compliance and ethics programs. So it's not just to comply with the law, but it requires that the program have some dimension of ethics about it. Now, the problem is that federal government requires these ethics programs, but they don't define what ethics is or how they're its use. There are a couple of trade associations that are working very hard to try to fill in the gap of what the government wants when it says it wants an ethics program, or you're required by law to have an ethics program. And almost always what these two trade associations come out with is something like virtue ethics. Because consequentialism, utilitarianism, and deontological ethics, it just really don't work very well, in at least in my view, in businesses. So back to codes of ethics. It's, you know, if you have the three main types of ethics, it always seems to me that virtue ethics always wins in being the best type. It's also probably the loosest type, I suppose. Accommodates for situations. Yes.
Thank you very much for your talk. I wanted two questions. One, have you got any other virtues beyond the four cardinal virtues which you think might be worthy of particular study with legal practice in mind? And the second question is whether you have a proposal for professional education for lawyers, say in this university or in law schools in the US, as to what this would mean.
Sure. So the first question. So there are many virtues, and as we use the word virtues, that are subsidiaries of these four. So I mentioned a few: honesty, punctuality. I think those are they all come with justice. I would say, just as a practicing lawyer, the part of me that practices law is that those are two: honesty, punctuality, are probably the most important in establishing the relationship with the client. Also, keeping confidences. So trust is important. So those are sort of subsidiaries. And if you're interested, just let me know. There's a variety of these sort of subsidiaries and tributaries from the cardinal virtues that are listed. Now, your second question is more interesting. Well, I shouldn't say it's a more interesting one. Maybe as a law professor, it's something I've thought a lot about in terms of legal education. For what it's worth, and I'm not just saying this because I'm here at Oxford, but I think you have a much, I hope my employers aren't listening back in Chicago, but I think you have a much superior legal education here in approach than we do in the U.S., and that's because I have a lot of ideas for the U.S. I don't have many ideas for legal education in the U.K. Mainly because if I were to make a suggestion for legal education, it would look a lot like a classical legal education here at Oxford, where you're studying history, philosophy, where you start with Roman law and then you move on to common law and then you study statutory administrative law, so that there's a build-up. So you have a sense of law having a history behind it, that law has a purpose, that it's, I think in general it's set in a more communitarian setting than we have in the U.S. In the U.S., we have in our legal education the first year of legal education. We don't study Roman law at all. We don't study logic. I think we used to. The U.S. used to study these in legal education, but put them by the wayside. Our first year of legal education is in English common law. And as it's been adopted in the U.S., but we study a lot of English cases. And in that sense, we're studying history. And the whole first year is mostly associated with common law. That comes the closest and is trying to develop critical thinking. But after that, the other years are, as I characterized it, completely instrumentalist. So it's highly niche. We go immediately from the common law, education in the common law, to do you want to study environmental law? And what are all of the levers you push for that? you want to study the regulation of the healthcare system that I work in. What are all the levers that you push in, as I've mentioned in another lecture here, the U.S. healthcare system has over 200,000 pages of regulations. We might often think that the U.S. is an unregulated country, but we're very, very regulated. Studying those levers and figuring out what knobs to push and dials to turn in order to get what your client wants, that's where our education is. I've gone back into the negative that I promised Edward I would stay out of the gloomy. So to me, now perhaps to many here, you might think that your legal education is trending rapidly to this instrumentalism. To me, this is the pleasure palace that I mentioned of legal education, because there's an appreciation for history and theory and philosophy in the UK. Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much.
You've virtuous anyway to all the person. Thank you again very much for your lecture.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.